The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
Oh, beautiful. For heroes proved.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. With its amber waves of grain and purple mountains' majesty, America the Beautiful presents a utopic vision of the nation, a wide, varied terrain of rustic beauty and good, crowned with brotherhood. In reality, America's open spaces are not free to all. In fact, visitors to America's national parks are overwhelmingly white. That's according to a 2011 report from the National Park Service, which found only 7% of annual park visitors to be African American. So what accounts for this discrepancy? In her book, Black Faces, White Spaces, Carolyn Finney delves into environmental, historical, and cultural studies to find out why the story of the American outdoors seems so white. Carolyn Finney is assistant professor of environmental science, policy, and management at the UC Berkeley. She was also chair of the Relevancy Committee for the National Parks Advisory Board. And Carolyn Finney, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me here. I'm happy to be here.
Well, that 7% number really hit me. What does it reveal, however? Simply that African Americans are not visiting national parks, or do they have a different relationship to the parks and nature in general?
I think it tells us something more about, you know, who we are as a country, that it's important to understand that the national parks don't exist separate from all the issues we have had both historically and in the present having to do with race and difference, the struggles that we continue to have, you know, to talk and relate across that difference. The parks aren't separate from that. So in many ways, it's like I'm always surprised when people are surprised by that statistic. But if I were talking about something like the criminal justice system and bringing up race and ethnicity and difference, people wouldn't be surprised.
Mm-hmm.
The parks are no different. We have a complicated legacy in this country, even in terms of how the parks were founded in this country. We have to understand that when the parks were founded in this country, there were people living in a lot of those places. There were Native people living in a lot of those places that had to be removed. I have to be really careful, right? I'm not trying to paint one group of people as being bad and another group of people as being good. I actually don't find that to be a useful conversation. What I'm trying to point to is the complexity. So when someone tells me that statistic, like you said, 7%, the first thing that it points to is the complexity of our history, the legacy of that history, and what that looks like today.
Well, let's look a little bit at that legacy. How far back do we need to go to understand the African-American relationship to the environment?
So what I would say is, and those who've heard me say this before, you know, I went to, a couple of years ago in Detroit, I went to the Charles Wright Museum. And at the present, the Charles Wright Museum has the largest permanent exhibit of African-American history in the United States. And that'll change because the Smithsonian African-American Museum is being built as we speak. And I tell people, when you come into that, when you look at the trajectory of African-American history as represented by the museum, you kind of start off where you're at the gate of no return in West Africa,
mm-hmm.
you know, imagining yourself as an enslaved African. You're suddenly walking into the hull of a boat, and the way the museum has it set up, it's two stories. So the first story is supposed to be the deck of a boat where you see images of white slave owners with the whips in their hand. And if you go below deck, you see representations of black bodies like sardines lying on shelves next to each other. And then once you walk through the hull of the boat and you're on the east coast of the United States, and the first image that you see of an African-American on American soil, it's an auction block, and then you see an image of an African-American toiling the land, working somebody else's land. So that's how far back you have to go if we really believe in the roots of our past. And yes, in some ways, it's very African-American, but it's all of our history in this country.
And at the same time, you know, there was this sense of expansion, you know, in American history.
Yes.
The move out west, you know, there was,
yes.
That's where the promise was. The Homestead
yes.
Act, you know, you can
yes.
have land if you just work it. So,
well, who the you is what's in question.
Right.
Who
if
could have land?
A European or you're an American of European descent, not
yeah.
an African-American, certainly not a Native American, certainly.
Right.
But I'd like to just move forward to your own relationship with the land, your family's relationship with the land as you were growing up, where your father was a steward working the land for somebody else.
Yeah, and I want to say that both my parents were. So my parents were originally from Virginia. They grew up poor, high school education in a small town called Floyd. My father went off to the Korean War, and when he came back from the war, like a lot of black folks, you know, at that time, in the 40s and 50s, who were living in the South, he said to my mother, they got married, and said, let's move north. We'll have a better opportunity as black people in terms of getting a job. And so he came up to New York. And he basically had two job options. He could be a janitor in Syracuse, New York, and Syracuse is about 5 hours north of New York City, or about 30 minutes outside of the city, there was a 12-acre estate owned by a very wealthy Jewish family called the Tishmans. And for anybody who's ever been to New York City, there's the Tishman Building. They own a lot
right.
of real estate in New
yeah.
York City. And they needed caretakers for that estate. They needed a couple to live on that estate full-time, 12 acres, swimming pool, lake. So my parents took that job. This was in Westchester County. And so we lived in the gardener's cottage on that property. During the week, it was like our own private park playing. We played outside all the time. You know, we could play outside. This was like in the 60s and 70s, right? But we were also in a very wealthy white neighborhood. So I tell people that Schaefer, who of Schaefer Beer, lived next door to us. Wingfield Golf Club was about a three-minute walk around the corner. So this is a very wealthy white neighborhood. We were the only family of color in that neighborhood. I still remember some of the stories, me and my brothers. I mean, I loved the idea of playing outside. But I also tell people, I remember when I was 9 years old, walking home from school one day, and you always had police patrolling the neighborhood because there was so much wealth in the neighborhood. And, you know, I was really unimpressive. You know, I had a little afro, my little reading glasses, my little school bag. And I got stopped by a cop right around the corner from my house. And he said, where are you going? And I gave him the address. And he said, oh, do you work there? And I was 9. And I'm thinking, dude, mm-hmm. I live there. But, you know, I'm not saying that out loud. So I just said, no, I live there. And I remember being really confused by the fact that he thought I worked there. And going home and telling my parents, and my dad then called the police station and really gave him a hard time about that. And then they never stopped me or my brothers again. That's the kind of stuff that's embedded. And this is the conversations we have in a lot of different circles today around race and difference that come up all the time.
We're talking with Carolyn Finney, who's the author of a book called Black Faces, White Spaces. It's about challenging the ideas that we have about the relationships between African Americans and the great outdoors, be it camping, be it adventuring, be it environmentalism. Carolyn, I'd like to address some of the stereotypes about black people in the outdoors here. We have a clip here from the black media web series Black Folk Don't. Now, this is from the Black Folk Don't Camp episode.
Camping? I just don't see it.
You can't really generalize to say all black folk. Most of them, though, don't camp. Because out in the woods with the bugs and all that stuff. For some reason, we don't like animals. We don't like wild things. We don't like things that we can't control.
We don't like campsites. We don't like tents.
I wouldn't, for the most part, do it unless, I guess, I had like some protection on me.
I was in the Boy Scouts, and I didn't want to go camping. Camping is not in our blood.
Carolyn, you had an experience
yes.
of living outside. I mean, to what extent are these stereotypes actually perpetuated, but within the African-American community?
So I think that's a great question, because I am a person who believes that we all have agency. And what I mean by that is we all have choice. But as someone, as an African-American, as a human being, as a person, I like to feel like I do have some choice in my life. And I first of all, I don't speak for all African-Americans, and I need to say that, too.
Mm-hmm.
I also understand that, you know, collectively, we have worked over time to define who we are for ourselves. There was a period of time in the 60s, in particular, when it was about Black is beautiful, Black power, and it, you know, it was a beautiful time. And two Black psychiatrists wrote a book called Black Rage, and they talk about, it's great, we, our ledge grew, you know, in terms of who we could be as Black people. But they also asked the question, have we also shrunk our ledge? So if you love French cinema, or let's change it up, if you love to camp, are you Black enough?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a Black thing to do? But in listening to those comments, yeah, you know, there's some truth to the fact that some Black people don't like to camp. You know what? Some white people don't like to camp as well.
Right.
But it doesn't change the fact that we all have a relationship with the environment and the outdoors. If you are breathing, you have a relationship. I don't care if you live in the country, in the suburbs, or in the city. You know, we stand on land, we breathe air, we eat food, we engage with it either consciously or unconsciously every day. One of the things that was really powerful to me is when I was interviewing Black people, that many of them, when I would ask them things like, how do you define environment? Or if I say parks, what comes to mind for you? Or I would say, tell me your story about the environment. Some of them would say, I don't have a story. And I would, of course, go, everyone's got a story. And at the end, a few of them would say to me, no one's ever asked me that before.
Hmm.
And for me, that's where the power was, that no one's ever asked them about their own story.
Well, historically, have visits to national parks been a white thing because African Americans may have been even barred from entering a park?
You know, at the core of the national parks, you know, and I think there was some really good intention and ideas and bigger dreams about what this country means and how we want to represent ourselves. And we do have these extraordinary places like the Grand Canyon. I think there was something really pure and good. But it doesn't exist separately from all the realities of all the violence that took place around a lot of those lands and on those a lot of those lands, to understand the violence that continues to take place around a lot of those lands, to understand that you have groups of people from various walks of life that are still fighting over their right to engage those spaces in the way that they believe is appropriate. So the parks don't exist separately. The parks, just because there's another story that I like to tell about during the civil rights, because you had all these beautiful parks, but segregation was also happening.
Right.
Right? That didn't change just because it was a national park, you know, even though at the core, the national parks are trying to do something really good, I believe. One of the stories I think I write about in the book is that there was a white professor out of Boston, sort of early 60s, late 50s, early 60s, who wanted to go visit Fundy Bay National Park, which is just over the border in Canada. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to take an African-American couple with him. And he knew that this was, you know, during the time of segregation, Canada's just right over the border. So he wrote the folks up, the superintendent, the folks up at Fundy Bay to say, you know, I just want to let you know I'm bringing this African-American couple with me. You know, I want them to be treated with respect. I want them to have a good time. When he finally got a response back from the Fundy Bay National Park, the folks there, they said, you know, we're really sorry. We can't promise you that they'll be treated well because we get a lot of American visitors here. And then we find out that the people he wanted to bring there were Dr. Martin Luther King and his wife, Coretta Scott King, who wanted to take a break from the civil rights movement, you know, take time to write all the things that Howard Zanizer and others who are creating the Wilderness Act at the same time the Civil Rights Act was taking place. All those ideas that I really believe they would have said, yes, absolutely. That's what you should be able to do. But they couldn't even do it across the border.
Well, but how about today? I mean, are environmentalists and conservation groups accountable for the lack of diversity?
There's a dominant narrative, right, about how we think about and have thought about the environment and the outdoors in this country. A lot of mission statements are grounded in that dominant narrative. And what that dominant narrative doesn't do is address the complex histories for people like African Americans and other non-white peoples, where it doesn't look all nice like that. It wasn't about John Muir being able to go into a park and talk about why we need to preserve this space, because he doesn't really talk about the fact that Native people had to be removed in order for that to take place, and that John Muir also looked down upon African Americans. And I'm not trying to diminish John Muir. What I'm trying to say is the man was a human being who was flawed, mm-hmm. who lived in a country that, you know, we've that strive to take on and engage this idea of democracy, which I think is amazing, and how difficult that was, and I believe is and still is. When you talk about engaging all the different kinds of people with our different beliefs, our different ways of living, our different ways of showing up, and outdoor spaces are not immune for that. They're not separate from that. So it's not, for me, it's not about everybody showing up at every national park, right? But there is something about, you know, I believe national parks are key to telling the story of who we are. I think it's important that not only that we visit the parks, but that we can also work at the parks. It's also about employment. Who gets to have a job? Who gets to be a superintendent? Who gets to decide what narratives and stories are told? What does it mean for a young child? Let's say a young non-white child, for instance, to come to a park and see somebody who looks like them and imagine, hey, maybe I could do this job. You know what I'm saying? I mean, sometimes we make really simple decisions when we're really young based on what we see and who is represented and where we think we might be welcome and how we might consider something we never considered before, like being in the outdoors. But there's multiple ways to engage the great outdoors. There's multiple ways to engage environmental issues.
Well, Carolyn Finney, fascinating talking with you. Thank you so much.
Yes. I was getting myself worked up there.
You were catching fire. Carolyn Finney, Assistant Professor of Environmental Science, Policy and Management at the University of California, Berkeley. She is author of the book Black Faces, White Spaces, Reimagining the Relationship of African Americans to the Great Outdoors. There's much more about the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
And you know, when I was in school, we used to sing it something like this. Listen here. Oh, beautiful, far spacious skies, far amber waves of grain.
And when Word of Mouth returns, the latest installment in our series on offbeat college courses, The Uncommon Core. Up next, world history meets video games. That's when Word of Mouth returns after a break.
Above the fruited plain. But now, wait a minute. I'm talking about America. Sweet.
Word of Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Our series, The Uncommon Core, highlights offbeat courses offered at colleges and universities across the country. In this episode, we're going to hear from two professors, each of whom stumbled upon a way to engage students in history using an unusual medium.
My name is Nicolas Trépanier. I'm an assistant professor of history at the University of Mississippi.
My name is Joseph November. I'm an associate professor of history at the University of South Carolina. I teach a course called Video Games in History.
And I teach a course entitled Representations of History in Video Games.
So one day a student said to me, gee, I wish there would be a whole course where we could use games to seriously explore history.
I mean, basically, they were interested in history because of games that they had played.
And it just kind of clicked for me.
We have a tendency to react to students asking questions about stuff that they've seen in video games, essentially by making fun of it. And it seemed to me that there was a lost opportunity in there.
One game that we played in the class was Sid Meier's Civilization, which lets the player manage a civilization from the Bronze Age all the way up to the Information Age. Another game that we played in class was Assassin's Creed 2, and whereas you do go jumping from rooftop to rooftop stabbing people, you do so in a historically provocative recreation of Renaissance Italy.
One of the characteristics of this course is that it doesn't draw from a very well-established body of scholarship. Students have to do a lot of the basic theory work. We're not looking at the outcome of the research of other people. So essentially, we're on the cutting edge, really.
It was the only course where I had to put limits on how much time the students spent doing the work that was assigned to them.
This semester, I'm teaching a course to a class where about half the students are female, which is a first, and I'm really happy about it.
One of the papers was about a game called Total War Rome, where a student looked at how accurate the representations were of Roman cities and of Roman soldiers.
I have a student who's working on Oregon Trail and the causes of death in Oregon Trail, and comparing that with medical history.
I played games since the 1980s when my father brought home a TRS-80 computer. One of the games that really captured my imagination was for the original Apple II computers, and that was called Seven Cities of Gold.
I don't know if I would define myself as a gamer, but I do have a PlayStation. I don't play all that much historical games, actually. To me, when I play video games, essentially, it's to get away from the job. You know, I tend to engage in, you know, other forms of senseless violence, if you will, on those games.
We're winning this fight!
Consumers find history very compelling, and they like societies that seem to have a past. So I think we'll see a continuation of the development of increasingly historically oriented and increasingly sophisticated histories in games.
You know, this is a history course first and foremost, and as much as they're starting from a place where they're familiar with, I'm bringing them into my world as a historian.
The Uncommon Core is produced by Taylor Quimby, and you can learn more about the series at wordofmouthradio.org. And when Word of Mouth returns, a more nefarious use for the internet, we're going to learn about Hacker's List. So if you want access to your spouse's Gmail account, or maybe to hack into your landlord's bank account, this online service will match hackers with clients. Hacks for Hire, when Word of Mouth continues after a short break.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The beauty and perhaps the curse of the internet is that whichever service or chore you're hoping to offload, chances are good that in a couple of clicks, you'll find someone you can pay to do it for you. If you need a reputable plumber, you might go to Angie's List. If you're looking for someone to dress up as a character for your kid's birthday party, you might try Craigslist. And if you're looking to find someone to hack into a spouse you suspect of cheating's Facebook account, well, there's a place for that, too. Matthew Goldstein is a reporter for Dealbook at the New York Times, and he wrote about Hacker's List. It's an online site that matches hackers with clients. Matt, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So how does Hacker's List work?
Well, it works, assuming it does work the right way, it's supposed to be anonymous, that you sign up if you want to have a hacking job. You create an account, which is done anonymously. Hackers register with it anonymously under everyone has a handle, and then you sort of negotiate with them. They bid for the project that you want, and the jobs can go anywhere from a few hundred dollars to several thousand dollars. And the service is sort of like this matchmaker where they sort of stand back and let the parties hash it out between themselves.
So is that legal?
Well, the people who have yet to ever tell me who they are or tell anyone who they are claim it's legal. It's not totally clear because they're sort of like a go-between. They claim, and they've done a little bit better job in the 3.5 months that they've been up, to try to ferret out jobs that are ostensibly look illegal on their face. But but I can tell you, a lot of the jobs still, if you go on there, I just was on there yesterday again. I mean, they've got a lot of listings, but they're hacking to my ex-girlfriend's Facebook account, Gmail account. I want something taken down off a website. I mean, a lot of these things are really, I would say, if not outright illegal, sort of on the edge of being illegality.
Well, so who's the they in this case? You couldn't identify who'd started Hacker's List?
Well, you can't identify them because they're not willing to come forward. There's a Jack W. who I've been talking to, who claims to be one of the owners. They claim to be based in Denver, though actually the domain name is registered out of New Zealand, so that's questionable. At this point, they're not willing to come forward. The corporate entity they claim to be listed under, I cannot actually trace it back. So their identities have been unable to be determined. They claim that they want to come forward at some point, but their lawyers have advised them for the time being to sort of lay low.
So
we're hoping. We're hoping they'll come forward.
You mentioned a couple of services that you can get there. Ars Technica, the website, also compiled a few of the listing, ranging from people who want to pay $200 or $300 to upgrade their Hilton or Marriott status to Diamond. someone who's willing to pay up to $2,000 to hack into a partner's phone. I mean, on the scale of things, on the scale of hacks, these are kind of petty requests, right? I mean, how dangerous is this really?
Well, I mean, look, I think most, it's not like hacking into Sony or JP Morgan or like Anthem that just happened. These are not professional cyber criminals who are out there. But I think what's interesting that I found about it is it shows almost how commonplace hacking has sort of come as part of the culture. And I think to some extent how the breakdown of what people's conception of what is privacy and what is permissible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look, the thing is it can be dangerous because as we've seen with cases like revenge porn and the like people, you know, offensively going and taking pictures that were meant for private purposes and putting them online. So there is a definite dark side to this, though one might say on the scale of criminality, it's at the lower end, mm-hmm. clearly.
Well, is there a legitimate use for this kind of service? I mean, requests that somebody might want, like you mentioned, having a picture taken down, that somebody needs to be done, but they need someone who's better at computers than they are.
No doubt. I mean, the problem is I think sometimes we use the word in the media, particularly hacking, and it already has like a negative connotation. I mean, there's what's called white hat or ethical hackers. And a lot of hacking is perfectly legitimate. And some of the jobs are of that nature. Some are like, I want to get pushed down. You know, if you know Google search and there's like some negative articles about yourself, there are ways you can push them down so they don't come up so frequently. You want to have a negative image taken off a website, you know, that you've been unable to do. So those are all largely legitimate and perfectly understandable. I mean, it's actually come up in some of the big corporate hacks. There's been increasingly talk about should corporations be allowed to do some sort of defensive hacking back to go after the bad guys. So or in some ways, it's also a form of private investigation. Like, say someone is harassing you online, you can hire a hacker to try to find out who's doing the harassing. So there's definitely a need, and particularly in the online world that we live. But I do think there's a lot of people who think there's nothing wrong with going into someone's Facebook account because I want to find out who they've been befriending and who they're talking to. And that's, I think, at just a sociological level is somewhat disturbing that people don't seem to be, you know, bothered by that.
Well, Matt, after you wrote the article about Hacker's List, it was on the page one of the New York Times. It was flooded with business.
Yes, it was flooded with business. It was I was basically their marketing agent, you know, inadvertently. The story obviously went viral. A lot of people picked up, you know, you guys are talking about it. You know, my contact continuing with this guy, Jack W., he sent me a number the other day. I think there were up to over 2,000 registered hackers from initially when I first started writing about them. I think they had like 30. Mm. You know, the jobs, they've had at least 2,000 posted jobs now. So it really has taken off. You should also know they've had some like denial of service attacks. I mean, hackers have tried to take them down. So their service has been very pokey at times. So it's sort of like, you know, get what you deserve kind of thing, I guess.
Well, given shining the light on them and the high profile hacks against Sony and Target and U.S. CENTCOM, Anthem, you mentioned, is the U.S. government and other entities going to be going after hack sites like this in a much more concerted way?
Well, you know, I think it's all a matter of triage and priority. In the initial story that I did about them, I did talk about there had been a sort of a broad swath crackdown on these sort of hacker-for-hire sites. And I think it sort of goes in ebbs and flows. I mean, I know from conversations with people on law enforcement, they were definitely intrigued about it or sort of watching it. I think the owners legitimately have to be worried, even if they're not doing anything themselves wrong, that their site has allowed a window into potential wrongdoing.
How about us as users? It seems like the more we try to protect our privacy, the more the market actually opens up to invade that privacy. Anything we can do to protect ourselves from this kind of hacking?
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, the easy and sort of but unhelpful answer is sort of unplug. I mean, and that's sort of what it is to some extent. I mean, you know, the FBI will now knowingly go around and say with big companies, it's not a matter if you're going to be hacked, it's going to be when. I think you really have to go about anything you do online, assume that there's a high probability that your information is going to be repurposed legally or illegally in some fashion, and to be careful about what you put up. I mean, I think some of it's common sense, but you have to really operate from the premise that a lot of your information is going to get out there and it's going to get into the wrong hands. I mean, it's not a nice, comfortable feeling, but I think it's just the reality.
Well, Matt, thank you. Matt, not good news, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Matthew Goldstein, he's a reporter for Dealbook at the New York Times, and you can find a link to read his article, Need Some Espionage Done? Well, hackers are for hire online. There's a link at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Environmental activists have tried a number of tacks to get people to act more responsibly for the world around them. The emotional, remember the Indian chief shedding a tear, the doomsday approach, education, cost-benefit analyses, shame. New research suggests another way to get people to think about how their behavior affects the environment. Pay them a salary rather than an hourly wage. Pacific Standard staff writer Tom Jacobs wrote about the findings for Pacific Standard magazine. And Tom Jacobs, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks. Nice to be with you.
So this research, where was it done first?
Ashley Willens and Elizabeth Dunn are two psychologists at the University of British Columbia. And they had the rather brilliant idea, I think, that thinking about the economic value of our time could decrease the likelihood that we'll engage in pro-environmental behavior. So they conducted actually five different studies to try to find out if this was true.
So what'd they find?
It really did. The first of their studies took data from what is called the British Household Panel Survey, which is a pretty big survey. Over 4,000 people who are salaried employees and another 2,800 who are paid hourly wages. And they found that even when they took account such factors as, say, monthly income, gender, marital status, hourly workers reported less frequent engagement in environmental behaviors.
So at the heart, the idea, time is money, time as money. So once that calculation is made, taking action for the environment decreases. Have I got that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. They found that once you get into that time is money mindset, people become, and this is an interesting phrase they use, irrationally overprotective of their time.
Hmm.
You know, every minute is worth some money. So am I going to spend some of those minutes recycling or doing something else that won't pay off for many years or maybe even generations to come? That mindset just puts you in a frame of mind that says, you know, I've got to maximize what I can get out of every given minute. Environmental concerns then sort of go to the back of the line.
Right. So walking over to a bin that is marked, you know, plastics recycling, it takes a little bit more time than just throwing it in the trash can.
Well, that's my favorite of the five studies. This was 54 students at University of British Columbia, and they sort of manipulated the students by having them think about what their first year out of college is going to be like. You know, how many hours are they going per week are they going to work? What they think their income is going to be, that sort of thing. And once the students filled this out, then half of them were told, "You have just calculated your future hourly wage."
Mm-hmm.
So that group was put in this time is money mindset, right? So after that, they were asked to complete a whole series of tasks, one of which involved cutting out shapes from construction paper.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that was just a ruse. The actual experiment was whether they would discard the paper in a trash bin that was inside the room where they were working, or go to a recycling bin that was just outside the room, just a few steps away. But still, you know, it took a few more seconds, right? Well, overall, 60% were willing to walk those few extra steps. But, and this was the key, they were five times less likely to do the recycling if they had calculated their future hourly wage. Five times. I mean, that's quite a difference.
And just based on a projection of what's going to happen in the future.
Exactly. It wasn't anything that had happened to them, except their mind was in that mode of time is money.
So salaried employees think, well, I have time to do this. I'm still getting paid.
Exactly. It's just a different attitude.
Well, you know, we often hear about poverty as being the enemy of environmentalism, right? You know, this kind of idea that the lower on the food chain, so to speak, that you are living, the less you can worry about things besides your immediate needs. So if we think that's true, it seems to me that low-wage jobs, people who are on the bottom of the economic scale, they are more likely to be paid hourly than salaried. Have I got that right?
That is absolutely true. Now, how much of that behavior is based on that hourly wage and being in that mindset versus, you know, simply not having the resources, you know, to engage in pro-environment behavior is a little tricky to parse out. But it's worth noting, again, in the British Household Panel survey, this effect was found regardless of monthly income. Even if you had a pretty good hourly wage, you're still less likely to engage in pro-environment behavior than somebody with the same salary, or roughly the same salary.
Tom Jacobs, thank you for your time.
You are very welcome.
Tom Jacobs, he wrote, Time as Money Mindset Decreases Green Behaviors, an article for Pacific Standard Magazine. You'll find a link to read it at wordofmouthradio.org. For a long time, people looked to comic books to escape real-world problems and dwell instead on fantastical struggles between good and evil, aliens, supervillains, and so on. Our next story is about how the industry, and a couple of superheroes in particular, evolved to become more socially conscious. A strategy grounded in capitalism, as it turns out. Comics in the late 1960s just weren't selling. This piece comes to us from Backstory with the American History Guys, hosted by historians Brian Ballow, Ed Ayers, and Peter Onuf. I'll let them take it from here.
In the early 1960s, new comic book heroes like Spider-Man, the Fantastic Four, and the X-Men, all created by Stan Lee and Marvel Comics, seemed to be rescuing the industry from a sales slump in the 1950s. But as the 60s progressed, sales declined yet again. The Vietnam War, civil rights struggle, and overall generational upheaval had realigned what young people were looking for. They wanted comic books to take on the issues they were facing every day.
So comic books, well, they turned the page. By the early 1970s, Iron Man had shut down his company's weapons division. Captain America had teamed up with a black superhero whose day job was being a social worker in Harlem. But perhaps no comic represented the shift better than a series that featured two green superheroes who had gotten their start nearly 30 years before, Green Lantern and Green Arrow. Backstory producer Andrew Parsons has the story.
In early 1970, Denny O'Neil walked into DC Comics for his weekly editorial meeting. DC was the home of Batman and Superman. But when he got there, his editor put a different hero on the table.
He said, in effect, that the Green Lantern book was floundering. So he asked me if I had any ideas.
The answer was yes. At 30 years old, O'Neil was part of a new generation of comic writers filling the places of pioneers who had been promoted to editors. And this new generation was young enough to be part of the highly political counterculture protesting the Vietnam War. But protests weren't really O'Neill's style.
I was never going to be a fiery leader and, overthrow the man. But I felt I should do something, and I had access to comic books, and I had had been given a blank slate.
Green Lantern had been created in the early 40s and was basically an intergalactic cop. To Denny O'Neil, he was an establishment guy, always busy fighting villains in other galaxies for an ancient alien police force. So O'Neil decided that the series would bring Lantern down from space and educate him about what was going on in America. Racism, drugs, violence, pollution. but he also wanted a more anti-establishment voice of justice. So he revived another 40s superhero, one that looked a lot like Robin Hood, Green Arrow.
Green Arrow represented the counterculture. For him, authority would damn well have to prove itself.
But what really made the Green Lantern-Green Arrow alliance different was the villains. Previously, Green Lantern had fought powerful aliens and mad scientists. One of his nemeses had a bulging, oversized brain with telekinetic powers. Denny O'Neil's new portrait of evil looked quite a bit different.
He's overweight. He sneers. He smokes a big, smelly cigar. And he reeks arrogance.
The bad guy he's describing? A slumlord. In the series' first issue, an evil inner-city building owner named Jubal Slade is trying to evict African-American tenants. At first, Green Lantern sides with him, only to be called a Nazi by Green Arrow. But Lantern's eyes are eventually opened.
And one of the people who lives in this ghetto is saying, I've been reading about you, how you work for the Blueskins, how on a planet someplace you helped out the Orange Skins. You've done considerable for the Purple Skins, only the skins you never bothered with, the Black Skins. I want to know how come. Answer me that, Mr. Green Lantern. And in the last panel, Green Lantern with his head bowed saying, I can't. And the rest of it is Green Lantern going against this slumlord.
But that doesn't mean he uses many superpowers. After the slumlord hires men to kill the two superheroes, Green Lantern and Green Arrow team up with the local district attorney to help take Slade down.
That kind of set the tone for the rest of the series.
Honestly, when I read this issue, it struck me as kind of like an after-school special. A bit cheesy and oddly overt. There is a bunch of action and adventure, but Green Arrow is also prone to these mini speeches about injustice. In one, he starts out with a line about how a good black man was killed in Memphis and a good white man in Los Angeles. Here's Denny O'Neil describing the rest.
Something is wrong. Something is killing us all. Some hideous moral cancer is rotting our very souls. In the background behind Green Arrow is Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy.
Well, the Green Lantern, Green Arrow series got a lot of attention.
This is historian Bradford Wright. He wrote a book on the history of comics.
The mainstream press ran a lot of stories on it. The New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Newsweek. And the term that came out of this, coined by the media anyway, was relevance to characterize these comic books that had, quote, grown up.
The series wasn't the first in the relevance trend. But Green Lantern, Green Arrow possessed more gall. It was directly calling out authority figures for acts of injustice. And it didn't take long for politicians to recognize the utility of comic books for their own messaging campaigns. New York City Mayor John Lindsay bought a page in DC Comics, and the Nixon administration asked Marvel to put an anti-drug message in Spider-Man, a message Green Lantern and Green Arrow were quick to pick up on.
And not too subtly. You had on the cover of Green Lantern, Green Arrow, Speedy, Green Arrow's sidekick, shooting up with heroin. And Green Arrow discovers that his sidekick is a junkie.
Though the series had critical acclaim, it only lasted a few years. By the mid-70s, the industry was ready to move on.
One day I came in and we were not going to do the book anymore.
I think there was kind of the sense of what comic book superheroes are really supposed to do had been a little bit muddled during the whole relevance trend. Essentially, I think comic book makers had concluded that their readers wanted less proselytizing and more punching from their superheroes.
In other words, superheroes had kind of stopped being superheroes. These days, Green Lantern's still around, but he's flying without his liberal partner and is battling outsized supervillains again. In the 2011 Green Lantern movie, one of the members of the intergalactic Green Lantern Corps warns of an evil life force that's
an enemy we don't yet fully understand. We do know it's powerful enough to destroy entire civilizations.
It's a far cry from the villains of the relevance trend, where bad guys were recognizable people with recognizable agendas. Now, in the age of the war on terror, government surveillance, and the Great Recession, maybe we're just more comfortable with villains in the shadows, ones we don't fully understand.
And that piece was produced by Andrew Parsons for Backstory with the American History Guys. Thanks so much for listening today. There is much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org, which is where you can subscribe to the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll also find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And while you're there, please tell a friend and please write a review on iTunes. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
With help from our interns,
Fiona Shea
and Katie McAuliffe.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.